Jim, March 31st marks the official end of the Sustainable Forest Management Network. What do you feel about all of this fantastic thing coming to an end?
Of course, there's a whole lot of mixed feelings around having worked hard on a long and exciting and challenging project and seeing it come to an end. Certainly, we have a feeling of very much of accomplishment that we set out to do a variety of things, and I think we've done those very well. We've met our expectations or exceeded our expectations in many respects, and I'm also, concerned, worried, whatever, about what will happen next, because we have built up a huge amount of expertise and particularly relationships between people across the country that are very important to the way that research is carried out, and in fact, about how we think about the problems in sustainable management of Canadian forests. All the way across the country, and I'm very anxious for those kinds of relationships and that built-up expertise to continue on in some way. So I'm seeing the end of the network with mixed feelings. Certainly, my workload will go down, and I'll be able to devote some energy to other things that would be worthwhile doing. But on the other hand, I feel very satisfied that we've done a good job.
Well, if we go back 14 years when the Sustainable Forest Management Network first got started, what was the view of the forest and forestry at that time?
Well, I was not really around with the Sustainable Forest Management Network at that point. That was before my time. But nevertheless, that time was an important time of transition in thinking around forests, when there had been some thinking about multiple use management, but it was very much oriented toward managing forests for single commodities, pulp, wood products, those sorts of things. And at the time, there was this emerging understanding of forests as ecosystems at the kind of stand of trees level, but also at the watershed or the landscape level, and we should be thinking about those kinds of things. Plus, we started to be looking at forests at the broad dimensions of the kinds of things that society values out of forests, not just 2x4s and toilet paper and those kinds of things, but recreational opportunities of clean water, participation in the kinds of processes that give us clean air, recreation, all sorts of things that come from the forest that are maybe products but are not related to the timber characteristics like berries and mushrooms and those kinds of things. Plus, the cultural and the spiritual aspects of forests, which we don't talk about too much, which personally I think are extremely important in the way Canadians see forests. So in 1995, we were in a time of growth, of questioning about how the forests should be managed. And it was a very good time to bring together university researchers and industry and government people to work together to say, well, maybe there's some different ways to look at this. Maybe there are some ideas that we should be building into our management practices and policies that would make our activities on the forest and land base more sustainable and would allow us to continue to provide this wide range of values to society in the future.
Now, you've been the scientific director since 2005. As the scientific director, how have you shaped the way the research has taken place, and what are the kinds of things that the research focused on?
Well, the question of how I was able to shape this, I was probably cross between a sheep herder and a fireman in the way that the network unfolded. Our research is focused around university research. The funding that we received from the federal government was tied to university research, and we have university researchers at 37 research universities across the country. Plus, we have a whole series of partners in industry of about a varying number, but around 13 of the major forest companies in Canada. We've got Aboriginal organizations. We have provincial and federal government agencies all around our table. So you know, getting university people to do things is often referred to as like herding cats, and it's very true, but it's even a more interesting process when you bring in all these different sectors from across the country. In my job, working with the staff in Edmonton and the manager of the network, we've had three managers over the time that I was here, but working to really focus the discussion of the researchers and the partners around what research questions are important at the time. What have we done research on in the past that we can feel that we've accomplished something on, and what are the questions that are emerging from the future? So there's been a whole range of research projects largely centered around policy and practice. We had a strong theme of looking at landscape-level practices that would look at how we should essentially zone the land base to determine which kinds of forest management could occur in different places in the landscape. In a sort of a nutshell, we're looking at three different levels of management: a protection, a conservation kind of level of management in which we aren't actually doing forest harvesting, an extensive area where we're using maybe what would be referred to as light-handed or careful logging, and then some areas in the landscape, relatively small areas, that would be devoted to intensive forest management. And this is a concept that has been discussed across Canada for many, many years, hadn't really been explored, hadn't really been tested as to how it might work.
Is that the triad approach?
That's the triad approach. It's probably most advanced in Quebec, where there's a lot of discussion around it in terms of how to build it into policy and to test it in kind of regional level experiments at the moment. It's very important in Quebec, but it's being looked at across the country in different ways. One of the other main sort of themes of our research was about the role of disturbance in forest management and how we look at forest management, forest harvesting and replanting and regeneration of the forest in terms of the natural dynamics of the forest. It used to be that we felt that, and I grew up in the age of, you know, Smokey the Bear, and we should, if, you know, if a forest fire happened, we should put it out. It was an unnatural thing. It shouldn't happen. And back in the 90s, there was emerging ideas around the fact that we understand it as to be now, that in fact disturbance is a natural part of forest. It has always happened, particularly in the boreal forest. Forests burn down on a regular basis. There's insect infestations and those kinds of things. And these aren't necessarily bad. They're a part of the ecosystem. And in fact, they have some beneficial features in many cases for forest resilience and how the forest grows and can sustain itself over time. And that wasn't really recognized in forest management. So we did a lot of research in trying to understand what natural disturbances were like, because of course things are different across the country. The pine spruce forests will characteristically burn sort of on average maybe every 50 years or 75 years, whereas in northwestern Quebec they would only burn in maybe every 500 years, but there would be more influence of things like the spruce budworm in eastern Canada than there is in the west. And trying to build those ideas to say, well, this is how forests are disturbed and respond and regenerate naturally. How can we make our forest management so it more closely parallels, or what we refer to as emulates? Can we capture those natural processes that are important in the way that we manage forests? And that there was a lot of research around understanding what natural disturbance was like, and then around understanding how forest management systems could be modified to develop or incorporate those sorts of processes into forest management.
And have you been successful in going from discovering what it should be and getting the people who work in the forest to take on those ideas?
This is an ongoing process, and one of the things that has been an interest to me as a scientific director was how to get the research ideas out of the research labs, communicate them to planners and managers in government and in industry and to policymakers to get the sort of new understanding of how we should be managing the forest into practice. And that itself, we haven't spent a lot of time studying it, but I think it's very worthwhile doing to understand how you get ideas established in practice. It often takes a long time. It requires a lot of good communication between researchers and the different groups that are involved in implementing things on the ground. But in some cases, we have been very, very successful. I think this idea of emulating or mimicking natural disturbance on the landscape is being practiced more and more across the country in different ways. Of course, each different forest manager will look at it in a different way according to what the ecology of the forest that they're dealing with is. But we can see examples of that all the way across the country now. We see the principles built into some of the new planning documents. For instance, Alberta, 2-3 years ago, got a new forest planning policy document from the government, and many of the principles that are espoused by the network were built into the regulations and the guidelines in that planning document. So yes, we've seen I think we can be fairly proud of our ability to get the research out of the research labs and into places where it can be applied by the people that need to use them.
Now, one of the other things that's quite impressive about the work that the Sustainable Forest Management Network has done has been your work with Aboriginal communities. What were you trying to achieve there?
You're exactly right that this has been another achievement of the network. That we need to recognize that across the country, the Aboriginal presence, and which has emerged now in terms of treaties and land claims and those kinds of things, is very present in the forested landscape across the country. That Aboriginal organizations and the Aboriginal population are key players in the discussion around how forests should be managed. And of course, these populations have been on the land for many, many, many generations and thousands of years, and have in many cases a good sense and a culture that's built around being on the land. The first cut would be that we need to be able to engage those populations, those communities, in the discussion about forest management. And secondly, we need to start to learn from those populations about those learned from the Aboriginal cultures about how they see the forest and how they see forest management, and whether there are some ways to incorporate that kind of traditional knowledge and traditional understanding into policy frameworks that are more of our sort of Western culture. And we've seen some very, very interesting developments in that area. There was a lot of work that was done over many years with the Little Red River Cree in the Treaty 8 area in northern Alberta, and that started off with work of anthropologists working with the communities and in discussions around how the First Nations people saw the forest and saw forest management and the processes about, you know, how the forest worked, and then capturing those kinds of things and then articulating it in a way that was perhaps more accessible to forest managers and other researchers. And a couple of years ago, we saw a very interesting development in that area where the forest company that was managing the forest there took the results of that research and those consultations and built them into their forest management planning, and actually changed quite significantly the way that they manage the forest in order to incorporate some of the knowledge and the values of the local First Nations into their management plan. And I think that's actually quite an exciting development that probably before the Sustainable Forest Management Network had done its work, it would be much less likely for those kinds of changes to occur. And I would say that not just through the work of our network, but of course other people are working on these things as well, but our network has been a very key player in this discussion, that the issues around First Nations and the forest are much higher on the agenda, much more prominent in the discussion around forest management than they ever have been before.
You've done all of this research, and certainly probably the first half of what the network was doing was focused on the research, but then you also had to take that and synthesize it and essentially take that knowledge and transfer it into the community. What exactly did you do around this in terms of knowledge transfer?
This was a very, very important component of the network activities that grew starting somewhat before the time that I arrived as scientific director, but it's been certainly one of my preoccupations over the last 6 years, is to develop a set of processes or mechanisms where we can get the research knowledge from the researchers and deliver it to the people that can use that knowledge in a way that they can use it. And we discovered very, very early on that, you know, academic researchers, us folk in the universities, are rewarded by our bosses for publishing in academic journals. That's what we do for a living, more or less. But that those journal articles are often not accessible, not understandable to forest managers or other, you know, policymakers or users, because they tend to be, it use, you know, certain kinds of language, technical language, lots of statistics and those kinds of things that aren't really accessible to, you know, people that have a lot of expertise in their own realm, but they don't have that technical background. And so we worked very hard to develop our knowledge exchange program, starting off with specialized publications where we would synthesize the research knowledge, try to communicate it in plain language to make it more accessible to a broader range of people. We spawned a set of research notes because we heard from our partners that you know, if you give us something that's 50 pages, it may be interesting. Maybe, you know, I may see it as important, but I just don't have time to read it right now. So I'll put it on a pile and I'll say, oh, this is my read later pile. And then it just stays in the pile and it doesn't get read. So we developed this research note concept that would be 2 or 3 or 4 pages that would just be oriented to capture the main themes, the main critical issues around the research, and that somebody could actually essentially read while they were standing at their desk going through their mail. And in that way would, you know, actually get read as opposed to waiting for later. Those were very successful. We're continuing to produce them. Well, we will continue to produce those research notes and synthesis reports to the very end. We've still got the whole set in the works right now. We've also had some really nice success with electronic lectures, these e-lecture series that we've co-sponsored with the Canadian Institute of Forestry, where our researchers have been invited to come in with a PowerPoint presentation that we can send around to people that are interested in it, and that at a certain time everybody from across the country can phone in and they have the PowerPoint and the presentation gets given, and then we can have discussion after the presentation from all over the country. And those have been extremely successful. They really always kind of impress me at how far-flung people are that phone into these things and are interested in the topics and engaged in the conversation, not just from Canada, but from the United States and elsewhere, that people become aware of these things and phone in and participate.
What happens now that the Sustainable Forest Management Network is winding down?
That's one of the big questions at the moment, but I am happy to be able to say that the position of the network toward what the future was is that our main business is to finish the work that we've been doing for the last 15 years, and that we didn't look to extending ourselves. Certainly the federal funding that we had a very specific limit of 15 years to it, and we needed to stick with that. So there was no real discussion of should we just extend ourselves. And in fact, life has changed since 1995, and that there's the perspective is different. Some of the things that the network has learned that, I mean, even if we're only interested in the forest, we really need to be paying attention to all the other things that are going on in the landscape. Alberta is a really good example of this, where it's not only forestry, but it's oil and gas, it's transportation, recreation, water issues, conservation issues, all on the same land base. This idea of cumulative effects, we need to pay attention to all that stuff. And the SFM network clearly was focused on the forest, and the new thing, whatever it's going to be, needs to be a much broader focus. It needs to bring in a broader set of partners. And I am happy to be able to say that our work to kind of facilitate or invite people around the table to have a discussion about what a new entity might look like is starting to pay off. And there's a new organization that for the moment is called Canada Land Resource Innovations, which will be a similar kind of partnership-based network that's more oriented toward networking and knowledge exchange than it is to research at the moment. But this is just the seed of a new idea that hopefully will catch on across the country and partners will come forward and support it to do the same sorts of things that the SFM network has been doing, but to put it into a broader context and carry on that same good work. And what I'm hoping is that we'll be able to, through that process, preserve and grow some of these very good working relationships that we've developed between forest companies and federal and provincial government agencies and the research community across the country.
Well, all the power to you if you can get oil and gas to the table.
Well, I think even oil and gas, I think in some respects oil and gas right now is starting to see the position that the forest industry was in 20 years ago. That it used to be that the forest industry said, well, we're so important in the land base that nobody can complain about what we do, and you know, if they just came out into the forest with us, they'd see that we're doing a great job and all those sorts of things. And the energy industry speaks a bit like that now, that it's very important, particularly in Alberta, and they say, well, we can, you know, everybody loves us and we can do whatever we want. But in fact, the recent focus on the oil sands work from the environmental community has exposed the energy industry to the same kinds of scrutiny that the forest industry was subjected to about 20 years ago. And of course, the forest industry ended up changing a lot, paying a lot more attention to the kinds of things that the public was looking for. It's not just about 2x4s, it's about all the other things that happen in the land base, and the same thing with the energy industry, that yes, it's important to get the energy out, critically important to the economy, but there are all sorts of other issues that need to be taken account of. And I think, in fact, the great advantage of inviting the energy industry around the table with the forestry industry is there's an opportunity to avoid going through the same kind of painful process that the forest industry went through for years and years, and that the energy industry should be coming to the forest industry and others around the table and saying, okay, well, how can we do this in a more sustainable manner, and what can we learn from the past experience, and how can we apply that on the ground?
What do you see as being the critical challenges or concerns for the future? I'm thinking, for example, climate change and what that means for the forest, and what it is that, with all this knowledge that the Sustainable Forest Management Network has brought together, how can that help inform these future challenges, and what do you think these future challenges are?
I think there's a couple of dimensions to that. One is what the future challenges are, and certainly climate change and our ability to adapt to climate change is a critical issue for the future. And wrapped up in that are things around species at risk. Caribou is a very high priority concern at the moment. Wrapped in also are things like the mountain pine beetle. It's been a devastating force in British Columbia, and now is kind of moving into Alberta and eventually will end up in my backyard in Montreal. I think that we've been protected in Canada from many insect problems because of the climate, and so if climate changes, those will increase. So there are these kind of ecological, natural system problems that we're going to have to face and to deal with. But on the other side, there are a whole series of issues around how the forest is governed, who has say over what, what ownership rights are there, and those are in some respects related to Aboriginal claims, First Nations involvement in forest management and ownership issues, but also jurisdictional things. That used to be that, you know, when the forest was just about 2x4s, it was very clear that the provinces were in charge of 2x4s, and so that the it was provincial jurisdiction. But now we're concerned about species at risk, water, migratory birds. Those things are all federal jurisdiction, but they happen on the same piece of land, and we don't really have good structures to deal with those jurisdictional issues. Added industrial dimensions, that competitiveness is very important in the forest industry right now, as it is in any industry. And the forest industry is changing. It's in transition. Like, it's likely in the future that Canada really won't be doing pulp and paper so much anymore because of the competition that comes from developing countries and eucalyptus plantations that grow maybe 40 times faster than Canadian forests grow. So that the Canadian forest industry is really in transition. So we'll be looking at new products coming out. We're looking at bioenergy coming from the forest, which brings a whole another set of discussions about, you know, how can we do bioenergy in the forest and maintain these other values at the same time. Certainly much of the research, that discussion and expertise that the SFM network has built up speaks to those questions, both from the ecological point of view, but also from the policy, jurisdiction, social, economic point of view. And so really that these are perhaps new problems, and that's one of my concerns about being sure that we are able to keep the university researchers that have been involved and keep getting new people in and do a better job of engaging the federal researchers and the provincial researchers into a research community that can address these questions that come up. I think the key thing is that what we know about the future is that it's kind of unpredictable. We're going to have surprises, and that in order to be able to address those surprises, those new things that come up that we don't see, we need a very active, communicating, linked together researcher, practitioner, and policy community, because the response to those surprises will really depend on the relationships between those different groups involved. And that's one of the things that the SFM network has really worked on pretty hard over the last 5 years, is to create that kind of working, vibrant community of people that are involved in the forest sector. And in order to address the future challenges, I think we really should be looking at maintaining that that working sustainability community for Canadian lands.
I have to ask you, how many young people, young scientists and researchers, went through the SFM to help bring all of this together? How many young students went through?
The easy answer on that is many. The research itself is very focused on involving students and young people in the research, in the training, and one of our main goals was to train new researchers and students that would not only be involved in research but would go and be involved with industry and with government, developing practice, policy, regulations, those kinds of things. So the network has been very active in that area. We were looking toward the idea that these new people, these young people, need to be trained in a way that's different from the way we were trained. We were trained in a very disciplinary manner. The future is interdisciplinary, and they need to have a depth of expertise in something, but they also have to have a very broad perspective. I had a conversation with the chief forester of one of the big forest companies in Canada not long ago, and he was complaining that his foresters knew more about caribou than they did about forest harvesting, laying out cut blocks. And that's just a sign of the complexity that has increased over time in the forest, that it's no longer satisfactory to just have a narrow view of what the forest is. You need that broad view. And so that was one of the things that we wanted to be able to encourage research supervisors and universities to instill in these young people that are coming forward. I have a number on the tip of my tongue that is about 850 graduate students that have come through our programs. I'm not 100% confident about that, but it's in that ballpark of training that we've done. And I think that's remarkable. It's commendable, and I look forward to seeing what the influences of those young people will be as they move farther into the system and start making the rules and calling the shots. Let me tell you this story, because you know we're always interested in what the impacts of our investments in research are. And the Network Centers of Excellence program over the 15 years that the SFM network has been functioning has become more and more and more interested in what those impacts are and has been asking more and more questions about how can you demonstrate what the impacts are. And that's a very challenging question, particularly for us who are interested in changing policy, because those things take a long time and it's hard to see where the investments pay off. Just to illustrate that, my own personal story is that I came to Edmonton, the University of Alberta, to do a PhD in 1981. And I came to the University of Alberta because I wanted to find a place where I could work on forests and soils at the same time, because that's my background and that was my interest, and that was a good place to do it. And I didn't really know how I was going to fund the research. I had a scholarship, but I didn't know how I was going to fund the research or how that was going to work. And I saw in the newspaper, soon after I got there, I saw an ad for the Heritage Trust Fund. I guess that was oil revenue money that was made available to people to do research. And it was just a little squib in the paper that said, if you had a research project that you wanted to do on this, send us an application. So I did. And I was successful in that, and that's what funded my research, my PhD research, which was done up near Smith, north of Westlock, and we looked at nutrient cycling in pine and spruce stands up there, and that was a really good experience for me. Generated some interesting knowledge. But then I went off and went to UBC, and I ended up here at McGill. And then pretty well 20 years later, I came back to Edmonton to lead this Center of Excellence in Sustainable Forest Management. And it's just sort of an interesting reflection that was a, you know, it's over a 30-year period that $30,000 that the Heritage Trust Fund invested in me as a graduate student, that's the training, the highly qualified personnel stuff that we talk about, they invested that in my research that was over the years had went all sorts of different places but eventually came back to participate in this Edmonton-based organization that actually has done a huge amount for research and forestry knowledge in Alberta. So just personally, I think it's an interesting story about how we should think about our investments in research, that they have a long life and we can't really predict where they might end up. But we should have some confidence that they end up in a good place, that we cannot lose by investing in training and supporting young people in universities.
And that's ever so true. Thank you very much, Jim.
Thank you, and I've enjoyed the discussion and the opportunity to talk to you.